Stand by for action.
Everybody, welcome back to the Punk Till I Die podcast. Neil, it's a very special day here at the Punk Till I Die podcast. Do you know why?
Is it because OJ died?
How uncomfortable is that going to be when he gets to the afterlife and he bumps into Nicole and he still hasn't found her real killer? He's going to be so embarrassed, isn't he? Actually, Neil, we're already in a wise-ass mood tonight because we've been joking around with our guest. Ooh, yes. This is actually kind of a long time coming. Years ago, when Beer City issued the reissues for this particular band, I had a contact with somebody. I can't remember if it was Bruce or who it was, but it just never ended up coming together. So we are thrilled to have with us today, musician, author, all-around wise-ass.
Nice.
Dave Scott Schwartzman from Adrenaline OD, one of my favorite bands, one of the most underrated hardcore bands in the 80s, in my humble opinion. How are you doing, Dave?
Great to be here on a national holiday like today. What an incredible day.
Exactly. It is something, isn't it? You know, it's for, when's the last time you thought about OJ previously?
You know, it's been a while. You know, when I heard that he passed away this morning, the only thing I could think about was like the commercial of him running through the airport and jumping over the luggage. Well, and like thinking, thinking like that's just how he's trying to get out of hell right now.
Love it.
Yes. Like I said, there's going to be some awkward interactions in the afterlife. But yeah, he's funny guy, man. He listen, at the very least, he captured America was like focused on him. He had to be one of the most famous people in the world at one point, right? Like 30 years
absolutely.
Ago.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, up there with Michael Jackson and any president, you know. Definitely. Boy,
another high quality character individual, Michael Jackson.
And then we could go Bill Cosby too, for that matter.
Jesus Christ.
Cosby's still alive for whatever reason.
Before I start mentioning like how much I liked Harvey Weinstein's film.
Yeah, well, I would say the problem is
everything goes sour.
We don't want people to think it's a race thing. There's lots of white scum.
No, not racing at all.
Yeah, we got the trifecta there. We got a pedophile, a fucking rapist, and a murderer. It's awesome.
Alleged. Alleged. Anyway, so
bless America.
So Dave is founding drummer from AOD. What you guys started out in New Jersey, what year? About 81 or so?
81, yeah. And before that, we were a punk rock band called the East Patterson Boys Choir, most of the guys in the band, and that started around 79, I think, 79 to 80. So, yeah.
And you were just a wee lad at that point, high school kid?
I was a high school kid. Junior high, when I first met these guys, ninth grade, I was only 14 years old. I think the year after my bar mitzvah is when I met everybody in the band.
Well, at least you didn't got that out of the way without disappointing your parents. You waited until after.
Yeah, there you go.
So Neil and I both have recently read your book. So you're just to give a little background on the band for people who aren't super familiar. Your story is kind of typical, right? Give people your kind of like your punk rock, your punk rock testimony. Testify.
Right. Right. We were fun.
Well, I caught him off guard there, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, I put him on the spot.
Sorry.
When you say testify, though, I mean, I like the fact that there are a lot of books coming out now by all these different people and all walks of punk rock. And a lot of these stories are very different from everybody else's stories. My story, definitely different from like the Harley book or the John Joseph book, you know, different like approach to the whole thing and different experience, you know. So I enjoy the fact that we came from this punk rock scene that brought in like all kinds of people. I mean, you know, people that you would never as a teenager even like hang out with or meet, but we all were like the island of misfit toys and just found each other, you know. I mean, it was a good time to be young, and I loved being a punk rocker when I was a teenager, man. It was a great time.
How do you like it as an aging guy? You still like it?
It's mixed bag, and it's a mixed bag for a couple reasons. I mean, obviously, it got really commercialized, and you know, it became a business. But now, like, you know, just the way things ebb and flow, there seems to be like an actual real hardcore scene that started up again from the underground that's starting to get big again. I mean, you got bands like Turnstile that were, you know, slugging it out for years that are playing arenas now, and you know, Amel and the Sniffers, and you know, bands like Gel and Soul Glow. There's this whole other scene, and for the first time in a really long time, I see that a lot of these kids that are into the punk and hardcore stuff are looking at bands that are present instead of looking backwards, which means that something is working right. Because if all you got is just the past, That's not going to do it. You know, it's not. There's no longevity in that. I mean, longevity in punk rock is to keep it going. You know,
I agree and disagree. But you've get into the current bands, that's fine. But I think you have to do some digging back into the past too to see where it came from, right?
Absolutely, and yeah. I think that a lot of these bands that kids are digging were raised on a lot of the cooler bands, you know. They have the reverence for bands like the Bad Brains and Minor Threat, you know. And, you know, everything got so really commercially crappy, you know, in like the late 90s, early 2000s with punk rock. It just became like, you know, something that like every corporation was just trying to suck the life out of, you know, and get every last dollar out of. It seems like it's kind of going a little bit back underground again. And I'm seeing like a lot of like, you know, cool house parties and stuff with younger kids. And I'm really encouraged by like in LA where they have these under the bridge shows, like the little, just announce a show on the internet and like everybody will show up, you know, and it's just like DIY the way it used to be, you know. I kind of like that part of it.
I agree with you. I see that same scene here, and I'm not really a part of it. Like, I'm peripheral to it. Like, I kind of know some of these kids,
right?
But yeah, man, back to the halls, back to the basements, yeah.
Right?
And the hardcore scene is real healthy, but unfortunately, the old punk shows like I like to go to and Neil likes to go to, it's like we're down like 80 of us,
right? You know? Right. Well, that's it, you know, and there's less and less bands touring. I mean, I just went to see, you know, the Circle Jerks and the Descendants last week, you know, and I see those bands every time they come to town. I hang out with them. You know, Keith is getting up there, you know. Yep. He's an old dude now.
He's got to be pushing 70, right?
Yeah, he's up there. And this is not easy to just keep doing these shows over and over again when you're that old. I mean, he's already had back problems and stuff. So it's getting tougher and tougher. And I think you'll see a lot of these bands just kind of doing their last shows, just like NoFX is, you know. Just, yeah. Hey, we've done it. Let's wrap it up, you know.
But it's funny that these are bands, you're talking about bands wrapping it up, like NoFX, they were big fans of your guys. It's like bands that you guys influenced are starting to wrap it up. That's when you know you've been around for a while, right?
Yeah, no shit, dude. Yeah. yeah. We realize our age every time we get out of fucking bed.
I'll tell you what, let's play a song to give everybody a taste of what Adrenaline OD is all about, and then I'm going to address this particular issue a little deeper. So what song you want to spin first?
I love Suburbia. It's one of my favorite songs. Our singer Paul Richard wrote it, and the lyrics are just like the perfect reflection on my youth and the disdain we had for everybody around us back in the day.
Now what? This was the
fast
first
as hell, and it's got melody.
This was the first song off your first single, right?
Yeah, off of Let's Barbecue EP. Yep, yeah. And it was the first. It was the first song that I really thought really like represented the band. You know, suburban punk rock. It's fast. Well, funny.
Let's sarcastic. Let's listen to the fast sarcastic song by Adrenaline OD. This is Suburbia.
Yeah.
Okay, that was the first from Adrenaline OD tonight. That was Suburbia off their first EP, Let's Barbecue.
Yes. So Dave, it's funny, all these older bands that are still around after 40 years, I know you guys are sort of in a, you still exist, you know, you guys play and stuff, but very rarely do you see one that has the original drummer. That's like the guy who usually can't hack it.
He's a unicorn, for fuck's sake. He's a unicorn.
I mean, what's your key? Is it Pilates? Are you doing the Peloton bike? I mean, how what are you doing?
You know, listen, if I had realized when I was like 14 and 15 years old and said to, you know, our singer, let's, you know, I agree with you, let's start the fastest punk rock band in the world. and realize that someday I'll be like 58 and still have to play these songs. I would just been like, I'm joining Flipper. Fuck this shit.
You know? That or like play bass, right?
It is so hard to get in shape for these shows. Luckily, for the last couple reunion shows we did, when the book came out, we did a show in New York City and we did a show in my hometown in Clifton, New Jersey, which is where we did our very first show. And I worked my ass off for like 3.5 months, you know, it's like eating chicken and salad and jogging and playing, you know, trying to play along to that stuff. The first time, like after we set up these shows and I sat down to play those songs on the drums, I was like, what the fuck did I just get myself into? this is really hard. But it takes a lot of dedication. And, you know, I'm a lazy person. I'll give you that right off the bat. I'm not like a guy that's in the gym all the time, you know? In fact, after the last AOD show, I dropped like 30, 35 pounds for those shows. And as soon as they were over, I was like, pizza! Woo!
So do you touch your drums when you're not rehearsing?
Yeah. I'm lucky enough to finally live in a place where I can set up my drums in my bedroom, and I play them a lot. In fact, everything really changed for me in the last like 6 or 7 months. I bought a pair of isolating Bluetooth headphones where I could play like any song on Spotify and play along to it. So, you know, and it's like I've become such a better drummer, you know, because I never had proper lessons. I taught myself how to play drums. And back in the day, you know, when we wanted to be like the fastest band in the world, there was no blueprint for that. It's like I just looked at, you know, how the drummer from the Bad Brains played, you know, his one beat fast, and I just played that over and over again until my hands were bleeding, you know, and I had blisters. And, you know, we didn't even start Adrenaline OD until I felt like I could play fast enough, you know.
What always amazed me was bands like, say, Toxic Reasons or even the Stupids, where the drummer not only played the drums fast, he also sang. That blew my mind.
Yeah, I've learned how to play and sing. In fact, you know, this is funny because, you know, I had gone up to the Punk Rock Museum back in January. Me and Jack from AOD had given a couple tours, and we did a live performance with the guys from Channel 3 backing us up, and Fat Mike joined us for vocals. And the songs that Fat Mike didn't do, me and Jack had to switch off. So I had to sing like AOD songs and play drums for like the first time ever, which was very different. But we pulled it off somehow. I don't know how we did it, but yeah, pulled it off. But you know, being this old and playing that this fast, you're right. The first person, like you look at Suicidal Tendencies, like they got like a drummer that's like 21 or something now, you know?
They had Dave Lombardo recently, but now they have, well, everybody in that band's a kid at this point, I think. Right. Except for Mike.
Yeah, right.
But, it's funny, right? Because you guys are like one of those bands that I think a lot of bands cite. Like one of those bands. Like I first heard
Correct.
Of you guys.
We are a band's band.
Well, I first heard of you guys because Screeching Weasel. Ben Weasel was a big fan of you guys, and I'm like, well, I better check this out.
Yeah.
And then I know Anthrax is a big fan of you guys, and you guys, actually reading the book, I was surprised how much you guys did tour, because I always thought you were kind of more like a New Jersey thing, but you guys crisscrossed the country quite a few times.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, being from New Jersey, it was really easy to play up and down the coast kind of, you know, on weekends, you know. So, like, we would go down to Boston or go up to Boston or go down to D.C. or Baltimore or Pennsylvania. We were always playing someplace, you know. In fact, it was like very, you know, I was looking at some of like our playing schedule, and, you know, 84 on, it's like we were playing almost every weekend all the time, you know, someplace.
I wanted to ask you about that. So the book is great, and anyone that is interested, you should pick it up. It's called If It's Tuesday, This Must Be Walla Walla. But so how did you, like, did you keep detailed notes, like, back then of every show, like Mike from Channel 3 did? Or did you, like, how were you pulling this stuff from memory?
Okay. There's two things that go into it. First of all, I was the only member of the band that didn't drink or do drugs back in those days. So, you know, I'm the only one that can remember these shows.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, and that really made the book absolutely possible, was there's a fan-run website called Metallopromo online. And the guy that does this, like, takes his favorite bands. He's got, like, AOD, DRI, you know, Anthrax, and a whole bunch of bands. And he takes every flyer and print ad he can find on the internet and from submissions from people, and he will make a concise, dated timeline of every show we've ever done. And this thing was amazing. I mean, you could go on there and look. He's got the flyers and he's got, like, the dates of every, just about every show we've ever played, especially going out on tour, which really made it super easy, because now I could write the book in order of how things happen. I could write the history in a chronological order. It made the book so much easier to write. You know, I just go,
so
and
you look at the flyer and you, oh, I remember that show.
Yeah, the flyer or the date. I mean, he had, like, every day we played on all of our tours, and I just had to think of what was funny that happened, you know. what were my memories? What is book worthy out of everything we played, you know? And that's how it came across. And look, you know, I would never in a million years have said to you, like, someday I would write a book about this band. I mean, we were, you know, our biggest goal back in when we started was, you know, to play an actual club. That's all we asked for, you know, because, you know, the whole hardcore scene was just starting off. There wasn't a lot of places that booked bands like us, and every place that did book us, like, would book us once and then that would be it, you know.
Enough of these guys, huh?
You know, we were like the germs. We would get bands from every, you know, club that we play, and it wasn't our fault. It's just, we had a rowdy crowd, and they just, you know, people weren't used to slam dancing back then, you know.
You but, say it wasn't your fault, but I suspect there was some excitement going on.
Well, we were, you know, from New Jersey, so we did have that little asshole appeal to us. So
it is something about New Jersey, isn't it? Like, they seem to have, like, a chip on their shoulder. I think it's because they're, I don't know, is it because you're not from New York or something? Like,
no, it's because we are literally the brunt of every joke in the country until Florida just happened, and then luckily I lived in both.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, but seriously, I mean, you know, New Jersey was, like, the brunt of every joke. So it's like, either you can, like, take it personal, or you can take it, like, sarcastically and just give it back, you know? You know, it's like something about the New Jersey makeup of people. It's like, when we really liked you, we would bust your ball so bad that you would think we hated you.
Yeah.
But that's how we showed our love back in the day.
I think, you know, that's how all young men show their love, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. We used to. I don't know if they do anymore. Everyone's too fucking sensitive these days.
Everything's gotten weird.
Yeah, everything's very PC now. So
I'll tell you what. Let's put another song in, Neil, and then we'll come back and have a little Oprah Winfrey moment.
Okay. Oh,
Jesus, I don't know what that means, okay.
Am I going to have a key to a car under my seat?
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
No, I'm going to try to make you cry.
Oh, excellent.
What song should we do next? Which 1 minute 30 banger should we do next?
Rock and Roll Gas Station. Can't go wrong with that.
Oh, there you go. Good choice.
Tell us what this one's about there, my friend.
This was written about an actual gas station in Elmwood Park, New Jersey, which is where Bruce and Jack from AOD lived. And it was just one of those like gas stations that had like a bunch of like long haired dudes listening, you know, cranking Black Sabbath on their cassette boombox while you're getting your gas pumped. And it just became a one of our better songs, you know. Pump gas, kick ass.
Not affiliated with the Rock and Roll McDonald's in your state of Illinois there, Neil.
Unfortunately, that's long gone, my friend. That's long gone. I think Beavis and Butthead, they always had a couple of long hairs. They used to hang out at the gas station and beat them up, I believe, from what I remember. Trans Am.
Well, this definitely predates Beavis and Butthead.
It does. All right, let's listen. Rock and Roll Gas Station, Adrenaline OD. Taking you on a trip back to 1983-84, Rock and Roll Gas Station by
it's from the wacky hijinks of the kind of the what's considered the classic record, right?
Actually, I think Beavis and Butthead, I think that was a 7-Eleven, actually, from what I remember. Maybe it wasn't a gas station, but anyway, that's beside the point. Come on, Tom, let's do the
Dave, you guys are touring the country. You guys are touring the country. You were doing well. The crossover like thrash thing starts to hit, right?
Right.
And you guys probably had some opportunities. I mean, that was always the legend, was that you guys kind of stuck with being independent. But you had some opportunities there. As a guy now who's 35 years past that, you look back and say, well, maybe we should have tried taking some of those opportunities when the iron was hot. Or is it more like, do you look back with pride and go, man, I'm glad we stood our ground? I'm always curious how people look back at a situation like that.
It's a total mixed bag, because I do appreciate the fact that we did stick to our ground and we were really honest. We weren't a metal band. We weren't a crossover band. We were a punk rock band that got influenced by the hardcore scene and became a fast hardcore punk rock band. Speed punk. I would call it speed punk more than I would call it thrash, you know? Sure. And I think that, you know, I look at these bands like that we influence, like Anthrax and SOD and Dark Throne and Death, and how giant these bands became. And, you know, it might have made things like you know, a little bit easier for us. But I think that we would really have been regretting the outcome. It's one thing to, you know, make money and make a living at it, but if you don't enjoy what you're doing, what the fuck's the point? And from day one, me and Paul, when we started this band, we said we're gonna do it until it's not fun anymore, and we stuck to that. We stuck to that, and I appreciate that. Punk rock ethos right there.
That was interesting in the book, you know, because you get to the end, it's like, you know, before you get to the chapters in the reunion, it's just like, yeah, we just kind of, it wasn't fun anymore. We were sick of each other. We didn't dislike each other, but we were sick of each other. And I think that's a real honest way to go out. And you're right. It's better than beating a dead horse, flogging a dead horse, as the Sex Pistols said, right?
A lot of people don't realize that. I mean, we broke up, I think, 90, 91. And, you know,
about 10 years. So you had about a 10-year run, which is a lot of time to get in a van.
Absolutely. And when we got done, our audience had left us. You know, it's like the hardcore people that were at our shows grew up. They had kids, right? Yeah. And then the next wave was like that Youth of Today scene, and bands look sick of it all, and the hardcore, New York hardcore stuff, you know. And that wasn't our scene. It was not for us to buy into that, you know. We were what we were, and what felt comfortable to us, like, you know, during the cruising with Elvis era, was we got tired of we played so fucking fast on Humongous Fungus Among Us that we were like, well, we did this. You know, we're all listening to, like, the stuff we always listen to, like Buzzcocks and the Undertones and the Dickies. And we were really just like, let's just try to, combine a little bit of the oomph with, like, that early punk rock stuff, you know. And that's kind of the direction we went. And then after Cruisin', when Ishtar came out, we were starting to listen to, like, you know, bands like Raging Slab, and getting into a lot of the rock stuff that we missed first time around because we were punk rockers. And, you know, it just wasn't the crowd anymore. You know, and it's funny because, like, I think that if Cruisin' with Elvis came out, like, around the time of, like, Dookie, we probably would have done a lot better, you know? Sure,
yeah,
but,
you
know, we had no following. It was like we were too punk for the pop kids, and we were too pop for the punk kids. So, you know, we found ourselves kind of without a crowd anymore, you know?
Well, and it does seem like you always... bad timing. You had bad timing a lot.
Oh, that's a history of the
band. I'll tell you what. We'll get deeper into that later. So eventually, when the band was kind of on its last legs, you did take a deal with another label.
Yes. We were really about to break up. And this offer came up from Restless Enigma, and
a cool label back in those days.
Yeah, they put out a lot of great stuff, you know, and they were a real label, and they were giving us an advance, and were letting us pick our own producer. So it's like, okay, let's just give this one more chance and see where it goes, you know. And, you know, in typical AOD history fashion, it was just like a disaster. We put out this record. The only thing we actually got off this record was the guy from Restless, Ron Gowdy, who produced Poison, took us out for burritos. We got free burritos. And we had a $12,000 advance, which was pretty decent to make a record back in the day. But we, between the studio, and we hired Andy Chernoff from the Dictators, you know, because we wanted a producer that we really respected, we made absolutely no money off that. And like a week or two after the record came out, the label went bankrupt, and all those CDs just sat on a shelf someplace and probably eventually made its way to a dumpster, you know. And that was the end of AOD at that point, you know.
Now, why
until
did
the reunion shows?
Why did you decide to call it Ishtar? Fellow listeners in on that one, because obviously, for those that don't know, Ishtar
was, but it's funny.
Ishtar had the biggest the biggest amount of money thrown at any movie ever, I think. And it was a huge bomb, right?
At the time, it was the motion picture company that put it out put millions of dollars into it.
Right.
And it was a gigantic disaster. And when we were making this record, we knew the same. We knew that no fan of Humongous or Wacky Hijinks was going to be like, fuck yeah! You know? But we were just going through the motions at that point. And I think that was kind of the direction that at least Paul was heading in at that time, who was still writing a lot of his songs. Because, you know, after like AOD broke up and him and Jack formed a band called Sucks, it wasn't too far off from the Ishtar stuff. It was, you know, it was more a little more punky, but it wasn't too far off.
It's like Ishtar with our hearts in it.
Yeah, so I think if, like, you know, the band, like, stuck it out, it would have sounded like that. But, like I said, it was such a weird time, you know? It's like, we would, you know, tour, like, the entire country and come back to New Jersey and play to, like, 30 people because people were so sick of us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they've seen us so many times. It's just so much you can do after 10 years of being in a band. And when we broke up at the very end, there were so few bands still going at that point. And I don't even know, really, if there were a lot of bands that started as early as we did. Because I remember when we broke up, like, Agnostic Front was still around. But they didn't start till like, 83, I think. Yeah. And there wasn't a lot of bands that were still slugging it out back then. Everybody kind of disappeared.
It's really funny you say that, because I'll take 7 Seconds as an example of that. So 7 Seconds probably, yeah, they kept going, they kept putting out albums, and they probably played in Chicago about 10 years ago to, I don't know, 80 people, something like that. But then all of a sudden they split up, and they're gone for like 7 years, and then they do a reunion tour back with the Descendants and the Circle Jerks. What that show that we saw, Tom, with Circle Jerks and Negative Approach or whatever. And all of a sudden, everyone's back into, oh my God, 7 Seconds is back. It's amazing. And the place sells out 1,200 people. And I don't know what happened.
But that was Circle Jerks were kind of the same thing. They hadn't played for quite a while either. So it's, you know, now Circle Jerks are probably overdoing it because they're playing too much, but maybe not.
But my point was that 7 Seconds played 10 years ago for 70 people, and all of a sudden they're cool again. You know what I mean? Even though
This genre has an ebb and flow. It's waves, you know, and it's like it'll go way down, and then something will bring it way back up again. And it's funny that you should mention, like, you know the 7 Seconds show in Chicago. I used to co-manage those guys for a little while. I think I might have booked that show.
Okay. Well, no,
well, you lost money on that one. But it's funny, though. I think part of it is the fans. You know, you got a band like 7 Seconds, so you got a bunch of guys like us, Neil, in the audience, 50-plus-year-old guys. We're starting to, I don't want to say feel our own mortality, but we know that this isn't going to last forever. Dude, in the 90s, I would go see all these bands, you know, because in the 80s, all the bands broke up. And then the 90s, most of them were playing again. So I was able to see so many of these bands in the 90s. And I so much took it for granted. I figured I'd be able to see these bands forever. Now we know that the time is limited, you know?
And on top of that, the audience of our age has really gotten comfortable just watching the show the next day on YouTube in the comfort of their house with a joint and some wine. But, you know, that's a reality, though. It's like it's hard to get people out. You know, like, we've been really lucky. Like, all the reunion shows we've done, and, you know, we always stick to that, you know, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut area, because we can't really travel too much outside of it because of business and stuff. Sure. But those shows have always sold out, and they've been great. And the last two, especially the very last show we did, which was, you know, the first time we played with Jim Foster, our original guitar player, in like 40-something years. It was fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic. It was one of the most fun times I've had playing an AOD show. So it's just, you never know. You know, it's like these people – there's also something positive about people our age that don't go to shows a lot and this is a special occasion for them because they grew up in the A&E and they want it. It's like, you know, I saw like people in the pit, they're like, you know, 59, 60 years old, and, you know, it's like, you know, I was hoping there was like paramedics on standby, you know, but it was funny to watch, but it was also very heartwarming, you know.
Well, I think, and obviously I hate to, you know, mention even this word, but a lot of it is the COVID thing, because you got a bunch of people who are in their 50s, they're on the brink of wanting to stay home anyway, and then you make them stay home for a couple of years, and a lot of them never came back. I noticed attendance doesn't seem to be where it was a few years ago, I would say.
Especially for the smaller bands, especially for newer smaller bands, it's very unfortunate. We'll go to show and there'll be 30 people there.
Of course, I saw that Circle Jerks Descendants tour, Adolescence tour in Milwaukee last year, and it was, you couldn't even walk in it, it was so packed. So, you know.
Yeah, I saw them and they sold out House of Blues here. But I'll tell you something, it's so odd because, you know, I live in Orlando. I had gone to see NoFX when they did their last Orlando show. It was NoFX, Pennywise, Circle Jerks, and who else was on it? Sick of It All.
It's like a big outdoor all day thing.
Right. It was an outdoor show at the fairgrounds. Now, I had seen Lollapalooza and Warp shows at the same fairgrounds. This was so ridiculously crowded. I've never seen this many people for a punk show in my entire fucking life, dude. It was like, you know, 17,000, 18,000 people. Wow. You know, it was so packed. And, you know, it was really an experience. I mean, you know, I every time, like, you know, a band like NoFX or Descendants or Circle Jerks comes to town, I'm lucky. I'm the old dude that gets to watch them from the side of the stage, you know. But, you know, watching this crowd, you know, from the side of the stage, that is just like, you can't even see the back of the crowd. It's so big. It looks like freaking Woodstock. It's like, I can't believe that punk rock came this far, you know? It's bizarre to me. It's just so totally bizarre, you know?
So are you objective enough to say whether or not NoFX was any good?
I would say, listen, I know a lot of
people sometimes they're good. They're real hit or miss. Like, I've seen them be brilliant, and I've seen them be awful. So I'm just curious how they're playing now.
It depends on the drug consumption of the night.
Well, it depends on two things. It depends on their drug consumption and alcohol consumption, and my drug and alcohol consumption. Right. It has to be synced up, you know? It has to be synced up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I really like NoFX. I'll give you, a lot of people think like, oh, they sell out. These guys were doing, you know, tours in a van for years, playing to 20 people, showing up at like shows and asking to get on the bill and stuff, you know, in the middle of nowhere. They really slugged it out, and they put their time and effort in, and they sound really fucking good now. Musician wise, those guys are all fucking solid, dude.
Yeah, you know, I think so.
And I really think that, you know, no matter what anybody says about, you know, selling out, what does that mean, you know, to a band that always has a punk rock ethos? You know, it's like Fat Mike, you know, love him or hate him, that dude is still a fucking punk rocker, in my opinion. He has opinions. He's not scared of them. He reminds me of other people I knew from the scene. You know, love him or hate him, like people like Billy Milano. You know, there was a lot of people that are outspoken that still are very fucking punk rock. I don't think Mike ever lost that, man, and I'll give him credit for that. And people could, like, you know, say they sold out, blah, blah, blah. I don't, you know, what is selling out, man? If you're not changing your sound and you're not writing hit songs for the purpose of writing hit songs, and there are bands in the punk rock scene that fucking did that, obviously. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
You know?
Still are. They're still on.
Yeah, there, absolutely. You know, and the fact that, like, these giant shows that NoFX are doing, they're not going through promoters. They're doing everything DIY. They're doing everything themselves. You know, they're putting on, they're finding these places that don't normally have shows, like, you know, parking lots and fairgrounds and you know and they're putting on these giant punk shows. If it wasn't relevant, people wouldn't go. You know, and I'll just end it at that. If people didn't care, they wouldn't go. I thought they put on a good show. I think they always put on a good show, mostly every time I've seen them. You know, there's been some times, you know, listen, AOD, hit or miss, you know. We've had some good shows, we've had some shitty shows, you know. It depends on the day. So,
yeah, I don't really have a lot bad to say about Mike. I haven't really liked the last few NoFX albums, but I was a big fan of them. Back in the day. And I think, you know, everybody's got their gatekeeping. You know, some people draw the line at Blink-182. Some people draw the line at Green Day. Like, for me, I don't discount NoFX because I know they were knocking out those, like, shitty Mystic records in, like, the early 80s. I mean, they did. They put their effort in. But I think there's something to... Once you've been a millionaire for 20 years, I do think it might take a little edge off you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but also, think about this. Think about, like, you know... Fat Mike had this enterprise with Fat Records selling, you know, like a million CDs, and then all of a sudden, like, CDs are fucking ashtrays.
Yeah, true.
You know what I'm saying? Gone, Daddy, gone.
And he got divorced and had to give half the company to his wife.
That's true, too. And I'll say only, you know, from my personal experience, I've known Fat Mike since I met him in 1984 on our first tour.
Long before they were big.
We did a show in Arcadia, California. And we were hanging out in the parking lot, and I remember the opening band was, like, covering AOD songs, like, two in a row, and we're like, what the fuck? So we went inside.
And you were going to play FX. Later? You guys were
going to play later? Yeah, we were the headline band.
Well, what do you think about that, Neil?
I thought it was ballsy, and I thought it was funny. I really appreciated it that they did, like, the first three songs were all AOD songs. And it turns out that was their third show they ever played, you know? So, okay. And I think we were probably one of the first bands they ever opened for, too.
I'd like to see what happened if somebody did that, like, at a Misfits show back in the day.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah.
Like, Glenn would come out and just, like, take the microphone and start beating the shit out of the singer with it.
I'm going to hit you 138 times with this microphone. Right. All right, we better play another song, Neil. That was a long segment, but a good one.
It was. I think it was AOD versus Godzilla now. Is that the next one on the list?
Ooh, that's a good one. That was the influence for the band SOD right there.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, you can hear that. Definitely the stomping. Yes. Yep.
Okay, let's listen to this and then maybe... Well, tell why AOD versus Godzilla? What's the deal with that?
Well, first of all, Godzilla sucked. We didn't have any personal gripe against Godzilla.
Edgy, man. Edgy.
Godzilla, that fucking piece of shit. The truth is...
About other Japanese things.
I think that song originally was going to be... non-instrumental. I think there was actually words to it, but it was so fucking fast that Paul couldn't sing it, so he made it an instrumental, and I think that's how that song happened. And, you know, it's funny because that beginning intro, that bump, 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 there's a band called, I think it was Diamond Head. It was like a metal band.
Metallica stole the Am I Evil?
Correct. And, you know, I listened to that one day on YouTube, and I was like, holy shit, that sounds just like AOD.
Yeah, that's a couple years before you guys, too, right?
It was before like us, but none of us, yeah, we weren't listening to Don. Trust me, nobody knew Diamond Head in this band. So it was just kind of
If it wasn't for Metallica, nobody would still know Diamond Head. I mean, they were like a third-rate Judas Priest.
Well, I mean, you know, if it wasn't for Metallica, how, you know, would the Misfits be selling out Madison Square Garden, you know?
Well, if you watch the documentary about the Annie Nowhere League, they will freely admit that Metallica covering So What revived their career. Like, they were dead in the water. And then, yeah, so, yeah, the Metallica effect is real. That's what you need. You need them to cover Rock and Roll Gas Station.
Well, Anthrax. You guys know us.
There you go. Do it. All right. Let's play the song. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Play the song. Yeah, play the song. AOD versus Godzilla.
Awesome.
Hi. Welcome to our album. We'll be right back.
All right, got you stomping along there. That was AOD versus Godzilla. Which album was that from?
That was from our first album, The Wacky Hijinks of Adrenaline OD.
Which was 1984. Now, what label was that? And tell us a bit about that label.
That was our own label, Byar Records. The label was never supposed to be a label. When we put out our first EP, Let's Barbecue, in 83, I think it was, we needed a name for the label. So Paul came up with By Our Records as a nice little pun. And, you know, after Let's Barbecue sold out a couple pressings, we're like, our friends from Bedlam were like, hey, can we use the name and put out our album on it? And we're like, yeah, sure. And it slowly, we started putting out, like, you know, a lot of the bands in the New Jersey hardcore scene. And then it branched out, and the guys from Bedlam took it over to run it while we were touring constantly. And it became an actual label. You know, they you know, put out, like, Flag of Democracy and the Raging Slab first album. Those guys got signed, you know, off of Byar Records to, like, I think it was RCA, and then Deaf American, and they put out Pussy Galore with John Spencer. So it was a cool little time to have a label in Jersey. I mean, it was the right place and the right time. There wasn't really a good representation outside of a really underground label you might be familiar with called Mother Records, which was considered like the Jersey Shore. They were so underground that, you know, and they put out records early on, like Chronic Sick and Fatal Rage and a lot of these bands, but they were so secluded in this beach area of New Jersey that they had no distribution. So, like, they would put out, like, a couple hundred records and sell them at the shows, and they, you know, if you were lucky enough to get one, you got one. Now those records sell for a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But that was the only other thing happening in New Jersey at the time. I think that, you know, Byar Records, once, you know, Wacky Hijinks came out, it gave the label a money injection that, you know, we were able to actually advertise all the time in Flipside and Maximum Rock and Roll and a lot of the bigger fanzines. And, you know, it helped us put out more records. So, you know, it worked out pretty well for us.
I'll tell you what, Neil. Go ahead.
I was going to say. So, just to be the people that don't know. So, they had you had four studio albums, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Wacky Hijinks in 84, Humongous Fungus Among Us 86,
mm-hmm.
Cruising with Elvis and Bigfoot's UFO 88.
Correct.
And then that Ishtar one. So, every 2 years, basically, you were putting something out.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, that makes sense. Okay. And then they were reissued. They were reissued a couple years ago, all on
Beer City.
From Milwaukee, right? Beer City.
Beer City. Yeah. And Beer City also did the Bedlam. Like, I've never heard Bedlam. Like, I know the name. Like, I might have, because they put out, like, a discography by them, too. I need to check that out.
Bedlam were really good friends of ours. They were kind of like AOD's, like, brother band. We played together all the time. Their guitar player, Tommy Kaprowski, was an original member of the East Patterson Boys Choir, which became AOD. And when we started AOD, he went off and became the guitar player for Morning Noise with Steve Zing from Danzig.
We actually had Steve Zing on to talk about that record because they reissued it for a record store day last year or 2 years ago.
That is correct. So Tommy,
he makes a living playing bass for AOD. Danzig.
Yeah. I've known Steve for years. I mean, he's nice one of my earliest friends, you know, since I think I was about 14. And that was my introduction to, like, those Misfits guys, because he lived down the corner, you know, and I was a huge fan. So he was my ticket in.
Oh, that's cool. You know? So how'd you end up putting your records out with Beer City? Did he reach out to you guys, or you were looking for somebody to reissue them, or?
You know, we've had stuff reissued over the years. Relapse Records did Humongous, and then the Bouncing Souls label. Chunks.
Wow, Relapse is a hard metal, is a serious metal label, Neil, if you don't know. I'm sure you don't, but
I don't.
And Chunks is, it's Bouncing Souls label. I actually had the CD version of Wacky Hijinks on that.
Right, right.
Which actually tracks.
So, like, I don't remember how we ended up hooking up with Mike at Beer City. I guess he kind of contacted one of us, maybe Bruce at first, and we just started corresponding. And he's done a great job. I mean, first of all, it's good to deal with a punk rock label that is a punk rock label. You know, it's also good to deal with somebody like Mike who is so fucking honest. And, you know, it's like you will. He hooks us up with, you know, merch when we go away for the shows. You know, we get actual royalties from what he sold. You know, it's like in advance. You know, if he puts out something, it's all like he does limited pressings, which is kind of good. He'll do like 1,000 or 2,000 at a time, and he'll pay us up front. So I don't have to worry about like this, you know, guy gonna just screw us over. You know, he's been really good, and the packaging has been great. He's repackaged these records really well. He's remastered them really well. So I've been nothing but happy with everything that Beer City's done with us.
Well, and it's nice to have those records back in print. I mean, they're kind of like cornerstone records. It's good to have them back.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's pivot to the book.
I have a lot of questions about the book. Sure. But well, Tom, you go first.
What made you think you should write a book? Who are you that you think you should write a book? No, what was the original impetus of the book?
No, your question is damn accurate.
I just busted
your head. No, it is. Because listen, I never would have thought about writing a book in a million years. It never was on my radar. You know, like the AOD reunion shows, that was like that was fine for me. I started posting on my Facebook site once that Metalla promo website happened. I would find out like what shows we played on a certain day, and I would post like on this day in AOD history, you know, we played like Waukegan, you know, and this happened, and you know, people would comment on it, and they were funny stories. And one, you know, after like a few months of doing this, people were like, "Dude, you should write a book." And then one of the people that said this was Steven from DeWolf Publishing, and within like, I don't know, a couple, 2 to 3 weeks later, I'm in Philadelphia signing a contract to write a book. It was the weirdest thing. It happened so quickly, and within a year after signing the contract, I had a book done. You know, I never would have ever thought I'd be an author. Not in a million years. I mean, the last book I read was like Howard Stern's Private Parts. You know?
Great book. So you didn't use a ghostwriter? You did it all yourself?
No, it's completely myself. Yeah. Yeah. And it was fun because it really required me to focus on every single show and pull out everything that was memorable about those shows in my brain. It was like, you know, thing, you know, it's like a shelf that was you've never opened in years, and you know, all this weird stuff is inside it. That's the way my brain worked. And as I'm going from show to show and writing this book, I'm like remembering all this stuff, and it's like, God damn, I had a fun life. These stories are actually really funny, you know, and that's how it kind of happened. And, you know, luckily the book has come out to like really, really, you know, great reviews, and the people that bought it seemed to really, really enjoy it. And, you know, I couldn't be happier.
It's a fun read. It's one of those things. It's not really a novel, so you can kind of just read a little, you know, read a couple pages here and there. It's a good like toilet slash before bed book.
Correct. It is made.
I'm sorry. That's why he made it. Dave wanted everybody thinking of him as they went to sleep, as they sort of passed into the nether.
I think if you read Mike McGrann's Channel 3 book, this is a good this is a good alternative to that, because Mike's is more. I don't want to say a like novel.
It's more like
Mike is an author. Mike is a wordsmith.
Yeah, it's more like literature.
And I am like the guy at a bar telling you the story of what happened to me,
at a show. You know? Well, exactly, at specific shows. So, but it's a good comparison because his is 83, yours is 84, kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know. But right. It's a good.
They both make you wish you were there. Sort
yeah, exactly.
Of. That's what I think. If a book is good to me, you like, man, I wish I would have been there for that. You know.
Well, that's great. That's exactly what. You know, I couldn't ask for anything more after writing the book, you know. I mean, I really wanted people to get a bird's eye view of what it was like to be a young person touring the country without, like, you know, any chaperones and just complete the freedom of being on the road for 3.5 months with just your best friends else.
What I really enjoyed was that you clearly, and from the beginning you state this, is that you guys just did not took yourselves seriously at all. You were like...
No.
Completely jokes. You were joking all the time. If there was a fight in the crowd, you'd stop and play like a fight song or something, and so that the
correct.
Fight would break up because they felt stupid. I mean, it's just awesome stuff like that. You know?
Well, that was our personalities, though, and it wasn't like anything was forced or contrived. You know, people ask, like, you know, did you make a conscious effort to be a funny band? No, not at all. We were just. That was our personalities. We always busted balls. We were just funny people. We really enjoyed just being, you know, making each other laugh, you know?
Yeah.
That was, to us, was a good time, you know? And there's no reason. It was, you know, back, you know, like I would say like 85, like a lot of the hardcore scene got very serious.
Yes.
There was a lot of violence.
Yep. Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot of bands. I mean, I would say that... You know, maybe AOD and Murphy's Law were the only two bands out of that whole entire scene that just wanted people to have fun, have a good time. You know, no fights. You're not here to fight. Everybody outside of punk rock wants to kick our ass.
Yes.
So why would we want to beat each other up? That makes zero sense to me, you know? So that was a lot of our ethics, you know? It's like, we just want people to have fun, and we want to have fun. And when it's not fun, we're gonna stop. You know,
very true. So, yeah, go ahead.
So a lot of the shows, individual show stories are very funny. But you, a couple things, Neil. We always used to ask people this question. I know he's got an answer, so I'm gonna ask you. We always used to ask people if they had any interaction with Ramones and how it went. We're both huge Ramones fans. And you had a interaction only like one real interaction with Ramones, right? How did that go?
just like the digits, I think, not a good one.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. At the time, you know, it's funny because over the years I've had a couple more, you know, trips down, you know, history with the Ramones that were more positive than the original one. But the first time that I remember, we had opened for the Ramones at City Gardens, I guess it was like 85 or so, and this was... the era when the Ramones were really starting to see like the hardcore scene like taking hold. So like they started playing all the Ramones songs like twice as fast as, you know, they were normally done.
Yeah.
We shared a dressing room with those guys. And to this day, I'll still remember, like, we were so psyched to meet the Ramones, you know? It's like, you know, it's like one of our favorite bands, you know? It's like, holy shit, it's the fucking Ramones. We're getting to play with them. We're so excited. And we go into the dressing room, and we're sharing this dressing room with them. And Johnny had his seat facing us. He wouldn't talk to us. He just stared at us and gave us, like, the fucking stink eye the whole fucking time. And then, like, this, like, giant fucking roadie of theirs, like, you know, the cut-off T-shirt and muscles, he comes over, he's like, listen, guys, the Ramones light stands, those things that they jump up on and stand in front of the stage, don't touch them. Don't think about touching them. If you guys... step foot on those stands, we're shutting the show off and you're done. So, like, you know, like, we're a punk rock band. We're like, yeah, well, fuck you. So we go on this, you know, we play the show, and I remember, I think it was Bruce, like, the first thing we do is, like, he tells the audience, like, what the fucking Ramones already told us. And he's, like, making like he's going to put his foot on the stand. He's like, should I do it? Should I do it? And everybody in the crowd is like, yes, yes. You know, but it was – I think that those guys were really – at the time – and I don't blame them. You know, history had left them at that point.
Yeah,
you know, sure. The bands that were getting attention were the fast bands and the hardcore bands. And nobody was really giving the Ramones their proper due for being, like, the people that started this all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll say years later, inadvertently, all of us ended up becoming friends with Joey, you know, through different areas. Paul and Jack were in the band The Kowalskis, and Joey was a big fan of theirs, so he was at all their shows. And then I met Joey at Raging Slab shows because he was a gigantic Raging Slab fan. And then there was one great night where Bruce was hanging out with Joey at the Raging Slab apartment after, like, a Cat Club show. And this is pretty funny. Bruce, like, was drunk. He falls asleep on the floor, and Joey starts throwing empty beer cans at him, trying to wake him up. So, like, okay, Bruce wakes up. Joey falls asleep now. Greg from Raging Slab is like, let's fuck with Joey. He goes, they had two phones in their house, two different separate phone lines. So they went into, Greg goes into a bedroom, and Elise, his wife, puts the phone by Joey's ear, and Greg calls the phone line. It starts ringing, and everybody's like, Joey, wake up, it's the phone. Joey wakes up, and Greg had squirted an entire tube of toothpaste on Joey's stomach. He wakes up, and he starts rubbing his stomach and rubbing his hair. He doesn't know where the fuck he's at because he's drunk, and his hair is sticking straight up with toothpaste. And he looks like a member of Discharge, dude. Yeah, I mean, that story was just, like, fucking one of my favorites. One of my faves. But, yeah, you know, that's my Ramones experience. They were dicks to us back in the day, and I think it was because they didn't really understand the hardcore thing, and they took it as a threat, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, it's interesting, because when we asked Rick from the Digits, he had basically had the same interaction with Johnny. Johnny was kind of an asshole to him.
Get serious, man. He had no sense.
It would have been that. Well, that would have been even later, right? That would have been even probably late 80s, early 90s.
Wow.
Yeah, maybe. But, yeah. 88, 89. Yeah.
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 Hey, I'll tell you what. So go ahead, Neil.
No, I was going to say.
Throw another song in.
Well, we'll do that in a second, because what I wanted to talk about, because I love this, is okay, so we talked about the Ramones. Let's talk about another classic. Let's talk about The Clash. So you mentioned two specific Clash shows in the book. Early on, you go see them, and obviously it was one of your first shows ever, so you were completely in love with the Clash, right? Early on.
Fuck yeah.
But then, later on, you're fucking standing outside heckling the Clash. So tell us a little bit about that.
Listen, the Clash was one of the first bands I really got into, thanks to my half-sister, and you know, she got me tickets to the Capitol Theater, and I was on the side of the stage, and I saw a little opening, like, when the band started, like, everybody was standing up instead of, like, sitting on their seats, so there was just enough room for my, like, 14-year-old ass to squeeze into, and I made, like, I was trying to get back to my seat, and I was like, excuse me, and I'm, like, going through this aisle and just pissing off everybody, you know, and everybody's pissed off, but I pop up, like, right in front of Joe Strummer for the show. I mean, literally, he was, like, spraying saliva on me when he sang. He was getting sweat on me. But that was, like, the greatest day in my fucking life.
This was 79 or something? 80?
This was 80. 1980. Okay. It was London Calling had just come out.
Okay.
And they were fucking amazing. They were so energetic. The crowd was awesome. You know, for one of your first shows, and my very first show was, like, my dad took me to see, like, Aerosmith, Ted Nugent, Journey, Mahogany Rush. No comparison, though. You know what I'm saying? It was at such a different kind of element, being in a smaller environment with the energy, you know? It was incredible. But then, you know, obviously, a lot of punk rockers started drifting away from the Clash around that combat rock era.
Mm-hmm.
And me and my friends had gone into New York City. There was a hardcore show, I think, at Irving Plaza, and it got canceled. So we're like, okay, we're in New York. It's like, you know, 10 o'clock at night. What are we going to do, drive back to New Jersey? And I remember that The Clash were the musical guests on Saturday Night Live that night. So I was like, listen, I'd been to Rockefeller Center before because I had gone – I was on that Fear show. I was in the crowd for that.
Oh, you were?
Oh, the famous Saturday Night show. Oh,
damn. Yeah.
Yeah. The only reason I didn't talk about it in the book was because it's been covered by Harley. It's been covered by John Joseph. And I'm just going to tell the same story. They put us in a room in the hallway and kept us there until, like, you know, Fear came on. But,
Well, that was like a who's who. Like, everybody.
Yeah, crowd, and none of us knew each other. The only person I knew at the time, and the way I found out about it, was a friend of ours named T-Shirt Tony, who was the singer of a band called Ultraviolence from New York. We ran into him, me and my friend Steve, and he mentioned that, hey, you know, it was Friday, and he's like, tomorrow night, Fear come to SNL, they're looking for people to slam dance in the crowd. So me and my friend Steve Cosmano were like, oh, we're fucking going. And, you know, Steve was going to have his dad drive us, and we were all set for this. And then it didn't happen. He didn't ask his dad till the last minute. And, you know, I just like, fuck it. I got on a bus, and I just took a bus to New York City, and I knew how to get to Rockefeller Center because I had been there before. And that's how I got to Fear. But years later, once The Clash were on, that show that we were going to gets canceled, and we were bored. It was like about five or six of my friends, and we're hanging out at Rockefeller Center. The host of SNL that day was Ron Howard, and I knew where the elevator was that all the, you know, the people from the show were going to come out. So we waited by that elevator until after the show. And one by one, like, the cast of Happy Days starts coming out of the elevator. It was like, I remember Marion Ross, who played the mom, and Anson Williams, who played Potsy. Yeah, and Henry Winkler. Yes, oh, wow. So all these people are coming out, and my friends at this point had been drinking, and I was still straight edge back then, but they're a little tipsy, a little revved up. And I remember my friend Pete, like, yells out when he sees Anson Williams, "Hey, Nazi! What's up, Nazi?" Right off the bat, it's like starting off on a bad foot. And then it's like, as more of, like, the people are coming down, or my friends are getting more and more rowdy, and they were pretty much like yelling back and forth with, like, the cast of Happy Days. I remember, like, the Van Patten kid, Dick Van Patten's kid. I think his name was like Vincent Van Patten or something. He was in, like, one of those. Oh, he was in Class of 1984. Do you remember that horrible
movie? Yeah,
he was like the blonde kid in that movie, and he came out, and then, like, my friend Pete is fucking with him and like, you know, quoting the movie and trying to start with him, and Marion Ross from Happy Days, like, goes over to him and puts her hands on his shoulders, and she goes, "They're not worth it, don't worry about it, just walk away." And, like, we're about to get kicked out of Rockefeller Center. The security guards were literally walking over to us to kick us out, and out of the elevator comes a Clash, and they're dressed in the whole Rock the Casbah gear, you know.
Oh boy, yeah.
That you remember from the, yep. And they had a little posse with, like, Jamaican reggae dudes that were literally holding, like, boom boxes on their shoulders as they walked, and a couple, like, you know, hot
Mikey Dread girls. Probably, yeah, Mikey Dread.
That type of crap. And it could have been Mikey Dread for the, you know, and, you know, we're like, oh, let's just follow them. The Clash are walking to, like, their hotel, which is about two or three blocks from Rockefeller Center. So they're walking down the street, and I walk up to Mick Jones, and I was like, because I know, you know, he knew my half sister, so I was like, hey Mick, you know, my name's Dave, you know my half sister Debbie, you know, and he, like, ignored me and was like just doing, being like a complete, like, rock star douchebag. And at that point, like, all my friends start singing the Kraut song Sellout behind them really loud. And they're heckling the Clash as they're walking. So for like three blocks, the Clash had to deal with like these punk rockers that are just like, you fucking sellouts! Which like, at the time, really embarrassed me because I loved the fucking Clash. And to be honest with you, I wasn't part of like singing sellout. I was just kind of walking with them at the time. And I felt bad, but it also, in retrospect, there was probably a lot of punk rockers at the time that were fucking loved the Clash, that thought they sold out and never got to tell them to their face that they sold out. You know, hey, you know, chalk that one under our belts, you know.
There you go.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
That'd be the advertising, Neil. Adrenaline OD, the rare band hated by both the Clash and the Ramones.
Never thought about that. Fucking funny. That's fucking funny.
Oh, shit. All right, we better play a song, y'all.
Yep. So, next one you had was the Nice... Well, I guess it's just called a Nice Song the on nice the album, song. But on the EP, the nice it's called song, Nice Song in the Key of B.
Is the name of the This is the in my opinion, my favorite Adrenaline OD song of all times, because it is just the perfect punk rock stick in your head kind of fucking anthem, and I love fucking punk rock anthems.
Well, there you go. You better listen to it then, and everyone else better agree. God damn it, or they'll walk behind you and fucking hassle you.
come to your hotel and heckle you.
Yeah, it's a nice song in the key of D. Adrenaline OD.
Excellent.
That was the band that's hated by the Ramones and the Clash. Adrenaline OD with the nice song in the key of D. And that was off which album? Humongous, Fungus, Agungus, Among Us? Was that off that
one? That was the, I believe, the last song on Humongous, Fungus, Among Us. And it's weird because like every last song on our record kind of signaled the direction we were going to head in on the next record, you know? I think the last song on Wacky Hijinks might have been like Rock and Roll Gas Station, and then the last song on Humongous was the Nice Song, which really, you know, was the direction we headed into for Cruising with Elvis, which was going back to our punk roots, you know?
Well, there you go. Yeah, okay. Okay, do we want to, Tom, do you want me to ask more things about the book? Because I've got a whole bunch of notes right here.
Here's the thing. Okay, so we've had Dave for an hour and 15 minutes, and I don't want to let him go without catching up with what Adrenaline OD is going to be up to this year. I'm more than happy to talk a little more about the book, but I don't want to... Like I said, I don't know. At some point, he's going to be like, you know, listen, dudes, I got to go to bed. Or
yeah, you tell us. You tell us.
Come on. Yeah, that's true too. You would know. Listen, man.
Hey, man, we're trying to sell the book. We're trying to sell the book.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Hey, listen, before we go any further, Dave, I'll tell you what. Let's do like your social media stuff. Let's talk about the book. Let's talk about where people can get all your goods.
Okay. The band is on AdrenalineODNJ.com on Facebook. You could, and Dave Scott on Facebook. You could find me pretty goddamn easy. What was the next question?
Like where are people getting the records, the book especially?
T-shirts. They want to get T-shirts or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Just come to Dave's house. He'll hook you up.
All the records, Beer City Records. They got them.
There you go.
The book you can get through dewolf.com. That's my publishing company. And if you're out of the country, get it on Amazon. And, you know, it's a little bit cheaper. I mean, when the book came out, I was getting people sending me emails from Australia. It's like, I want your book, but it's like $60 to get it sent to Australia. No, yeah. It's like, holy shit.
Yeah, foreign shipping is a bitch.
I know. It's like, I just want to, like, put the whole book in like a bottle and just send it out to the ocean, just let it get there eventually.
Well, are you going to do one of those audiobook things where you read the whole thing?
I've been asked that a bunch of times. I've actually got a friend who is blind from the New Jersey scene that keeps asking me. I eventually will do this. I've just been so busy that I haven't really had the time to sit down and do it. And I think it'll eventually happen. There's, you know, the thing with that's, you know, a lot of people don't know about the book is, like, I'm presently working on the screenplay based on the book.
Is that right?
Oh, no.
Yeah. And what? I mean, if I was to tell you the people that are interested in putting this out, it would blow your fucking mind. I have no idea how I got on the radar of so many people that are so successful in Hollywood, but apparently, this is going to be either a movie or possibly, like, if it goes too long, like a Netflix or HBO series or something, you know, a Max series.
That almost might work better just because it is kind of a niche, you know, a niche kind of thing. But no, that would be awesome. I'd love that.
Can I play Joe Strummer in the movie?
I'm wondering which one of the kids from Stranger Things is going to play a young Dave Strummer.
Exactly. I'm always getting asked that, but I tell people, it's like, I'm writing it. I don't, you know, it's not in my hands who's going to star in it, you know?
I don't care who plays me as long as they're very handsome.
Exactly. But
oh, so it's fiction. You know, okay.
It is based on the book, you know, and it gives me some leeway. And the thing that I'm doing that is very different from any movie of its kind that's ever been done is this is not a biopic about Adrenaline OD. That is not going to get people to go to a movie theater at all. I'm writing a comedy road movie, coming of age buddy movie is on the likes of National Lampoon's Vacation, Bad News Bears 2. It's that kind of movie.
Oh,
and it'll have great music in the background.
Oh yeah. It's in all the funny stuff that happened to us through our entire history is condensed into one tour, and that seems to get everybody's interest when I give them the synopsis, because this is going to be totally made into something soon. And I'm already having to sign up with the Writers Guild. You know,
luckily they're not on strike anymore. Luckily, huh?
Yeah, new shit. Not for me. Good timing.
Well, it's funny, you know, as a guy who's, like I said, I'm a 50-year-old guy who's just been into punk rock for 35 years. You know, since I was a kid myself.
Yeah.
The thing with all these books, your books, Mike's book, the thing that always blows me away is the bills. Where it'd be like, oh, we played a show with, you know, the Dickies and the Exploited at some VFW hall in, you know, Kansas or something. You know, all these bands that are now legendary. It's just that's cool stuff, man. Like I said, I don't know if it's a general interest topic, but for those of us who've been in the scene forever, it's just like, it blows our mind. Like, we'd pay $100 now to see this at a hockey rink. You know,
so I get that a lot. I mean, you know, I remember, like, you know, certain shows we did, like San Diego, we played with Fear and SNFU and Gangrene all on the same show.
Yeah.
You know, and Dickies and Vandals and, who else was it? Maybe Social Distortion. Like, you know, there's like some of these bills were just like gigantic, you know.
Yeah, and even some of them were like middle America, like we just weird, you know, maybe Chicago or somewhere. There'd just be a you guys be from all over the country. You just converge on one gig.
But yep. Played with Exploited and Dr. No in Chicago, you know?
Here's a question about that, though. Here's a question about that, which we're all thinking, I'm sure. So when you do something like that, are you hanging out with those other bands beforehand, or do you just all ignore each other and stay at the bar and then go and do your thing and then leave?
You know, the one thing I could definitely tell you about Adrenaline OD, and you brought this up earlier about us being a band, bands loved fucking hanging out with us because we partied and we were fun.
Yeah.
And we were one of those bands that would get along with bands that nobody else would even, you know, want to hang out with, you know? I mean, we were really good friends with like bands like Battalion of Saints, Agnostic Front. And back in those days, people were scared of these bands, you know?
Yeah, but I'm still scared a little bit scared of them.
Yeah, we really got along with everybody really well. I mean,
Hold on a second. See, and one of the things I love about the book is you're very honest. And you do talk about the bands maybe that you didn't get on with. And Ramones was one,
You just sit there and stare at them.
Yeah.
The Accused was another. Tell us about The Accused.
Yeah, that was the only other band. You know, we were big fans of them. We grew up on like that early scene, so we were into like the Farts, so we knew like the whole history of the Q's, and we were onto them. And, you know, when we played in Seattle at the Rock Theater, you know, like we went up and said hi to them, they just like ignored us, man. We never got like any kind of diss like we got from this band before. We later found out that they were pissed off because they had to open for us.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And so that's what it was all about. But, you know, it's like, Jesus Christ, dude, we came from New Jersey and you're fucking a Seattle band, you know, get over it. you know, it's like any band that came to New Jersey, we would open for them, you know, and it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Right. Even that if you was drew really, better and give them your money. Yeah.
And it's not that they were like, you know, like got in a fight with us or anything. They just gave us a cold shoulder, and we weren't used to that because we got along with everybody. We really were just such fans of hardcore punk. And that's one thing I could say about AOD. We were music fans. You know, we were really into what we fucking played. You know, we were into the scene. We had everybody's records. I collected flyers, you know, every place I went. Hardcore punk was our lives, you know? So, you know, it's like when you find somebody that, like, doesn't want to gel with you, you know, it was like, what the fuck? Come on, you know?
Well, I love that, too, at the end of the book, where it's Bruce that lives by you.
He moved back to Connecticut. Bruce had moved down to Florida. I think it was like 7 or 8 years ago now to take care of his mom after his dad passed away. He lived in Connecticut and he left like everybody he knew and like lived with his mom at this little house in a retirement community with nothing but like a couple of old people and cows, and that was it. It was like an hour for me. I mean, I felt bad for him, you know, and his mom, you know, passed away last year, and he finally moved back to Connecticut, and it's like, man, you talk about somebody that just like is alive again after, you know, being in a cocoon, you know. I felt bad for him down here. He did not enjoy it. You know, I mean, I live in a part of Florida, you know, in the Orlando area, which is, you know, we've got a lot of transplants from all over the country here. It's, you know, it's very few people. Yeah, very few people are actually Floridians in my area. So it's like I meet like people that were at, you know, had seen us in Milwaukee and places like that moved to town. For Bruce, there was none of that, you know. And like if Bruce was going to, you know, come to Orlando to see a show, it was like an hour plus ride from his house and he'd have to stay overnight with me because it's too far for him to drive back, you know.
So I appreciate the fact that you guys were going to shows still, you know, and you were still into it, you know, 50 something years old, still going to shows. That was kind of my original point with that. I just think that's cool.
I never stopped. And I'll be honest with you. And I say this about people in punk rock and that were in the hardcore scene, the ones that it meant the most to, they're never going to get out of it. You know, yeah. It's always going to be a major part of their life. For other people, you know, they'll have kids. You know, they might like listen to some old records here and there. But like, I'll be honest, if Agnostic Front or the Circle Jerks or any of my old friends like are playing Orlando, I'm front row center, and I don't care if like there's fucking young guys jumping on my fucking head. I'm still front row center. I don't care, you know.
That's awesome, dude. I mean, like I said, we're kind of the same way. We're still out, you know. I'm going to Chicago, meet up with Neil for a show. We still are, you know, go to a couple a month. And I don't know. You know, I sometimes joke about the fact that I'm like 35 years past where my mother said I'd outgrow this shit. You know?
Yeah, dude. There'll be a day where I'm going to be in the pit with a colostomy bag attached.
just twirl it over your head, toss it into the crowd. Exactly. Like,
where has this interview gone? I don't know.
But this is my life. This is
You've had to work a job. It's not like you didn't make a living doing it, but you just never got out of it.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm lucky because I work for myself. My job is making merchandise for bands that go on tour.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
I've always stayed in the business. So, luckily, and it's funny because in the 80s, not many people know this. I'm probably a lot more famous for something else that is not anything to do with Adrenaline OD.
Oh.
But back in the 80s, when I had to get a job, like after our 85 tour, I found this job with a company that made all the like patches and stickers and stuff for like for a lot of bands back in the day. And buttons and stuff like that, all the swag merch. And when I started working for this company, like this guy only had like Duran Duran and Wham and Aha. And I was like, there's like bands like Metallica and Anthrax that are fucking Slayer that you should be doing patches on.
Yeah.
And pretty much 90% of the embroidered patches and back patches that you see on those denim vests through the entire 80s, I was the one that designed
that. Oh!
Yeah.
I had
a
few of those over the years. Still
do. The company got licensed. We did like all the merchandise for Guns N' Roses. In fact, I designed the patches for the Rolling Stones Steel Wheels tour, and I had to go to a meeting room and show Mick Jagger like six different layouts of patches, and he had to pick the one that they were going to use
for
the tour. So I've had this like weird life outside of AOD that's probably the next book, to be honest with you.
That's funny that Mick Jagger. I'm impressed that Mick Jagger's that hands-on with something as small as a patch.
Well, with the Steel Wheels tour, he had one meeting with all the licensees, that the shirt people, the hat people, everybody. And he was in town for one day, and he had the approval. Correct. Yeah. One at a time. We all waited out in a room and showed him all the mock-ups and stuff. And that was it. He picked out like one of my designs, and that was sold on the entire Steel Wheels tour. And like, if you've ever seen like the Kiss, remember the Kiss solo albums?
Oh yeah.
Okay, well, there were embroidered patches of each of those guys from that solo album's cover that I was one that designed all those patches. I designed like the Guns N' Roses, like the skull, from the album cover on a patch with the skulls and the cross. And we work with like some of the bands that we worked with during those years were like so fucking funny, man. It's like I did like licensed merchandise for Vanilla Ice.
You dirty sellout. Look at you. What a sellout.
I did New Kids on the Block.
It was his job, I don't think that's a selling out.
Sell out! Sell out!
And then like once like the glam metal scene happened, like Warrant and Slaughter and all those bands, I did every single one of them,
That's funny.
So, wow. It's odd. I mean, that was my life, outside of AOD, that was my job.
I mean, it beats working in a coal mine, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, and I learned everything about now. I took that job as like going to college, you know. It's like I learned everything about it, so I was able to just do it myself eventually.
Yeah, you can do your own.
I don't have to work for anybody. I'm making like $1 million for, and you know they're not paying me accurately.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I'll tell you what. Well, I'll tell you what, Neil. Let's do a song and then
someone ringing a doorbell.
Dave's having appliances delivered.
it's a late night.
It's Jehovah's Vanilla Ice. Witness. Vanilla Ice coming to pick up his patches.
I'll tell you what. Let's play a song, and then we'll come back, and we're going to catch up with what AOD is going to do this year, and then we'll let Dave go in peace.
Hold on, I got fucking more questions about the fucking but the book.
Well, we've had it for an hour and a half.
Hold on, I got to know this.
All right, then go ahead.
I got to know this. So, Mike McGran, Channel 3, told us funny misfit stories, but you have way more funny misfit stories. So tell us about fucking
Uncle Glenn.
Glenn Deck, yeah, Uncle Glenn and his mom yelling him about lasagna being ready and shit like that. Tell us about how you knew those guys.
Okay. Those freaking Italians, man. It all comes back to pasta, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I met those guys through my friend Steve Zing. I was friends with Steve first. Everybody in AOD were gigantic Misfits fans. I mean, for us, you know, nobody really knew them back then. The only people that knew them were like people in the tri-state area that had seen them and record collectors that were able to somehow get a copy of their singles, which really didn't have great distribution. And I think the first time I remember like going to Steve's house, and we would like hang outside Jerry and Doyle's house. They had like a gated driveway, and they rehearsed in their garage, which they called the pit. And we would stay outside of that gated driveway and just listen to them practice. And you know, I was like, I gotta figure out a way to get into there. I need to see this. See them practice, you know. It's like seeing, you know, the Beatles, tucked away. You know, it's like here they are, right behind this gate. You know, and another funny thing about Jerry Doyle's house and that gate, they had two dogs. I think they were both males, and these dogs were always humping each other constantly. Every time I ever came there, these dogs are humping each other. I don't know what the hell they fed these dogs. Anyway, so back to the Misfits. So one day I had this idea. I'm going to tell the Misfits that I'm going to write a story about them for the Village Voice. And is it okay if I come down with a tape recorder and a photographer? Now, they didn't know I was fucking probably 14 years old at the time, 15 maybe. So they're like, yeah, sure, because nobody gave a fuck about the Misfits back then. There was no Rolling Stones or Village Voice, you know, asking for anything about the Misfits back then. Yeah. So like, sure, come on down. So I invited Paul from AOD to come with me as the photographer. Paul didn't even bring a fucking camera.
That's classic. Yeah.
And we get invited into the pit, and we got to watch them rehearse and record some of their, you know, biggest songs, including Mommy Can I Go Out Till Tonight, Queen Wasp, you know, and I was lucky enough to have brought with me my portable tape cassette recorder. And I asked Glenn, is it okay if I tape the rehearsal? He's like, yeah, sure. So I taped the rehearsal. I had this recording of what became the only Misfits rehearsal recording ever made. I don't know why these guys never recorded the rehearsals. Baffles me to this day. But I had this only recording, and I would trade it with like a lot of my friends. You know, I made copies for, you know, like Tommy Kaprowski from, you know, Morning Noise, and guys from Electric Frankenstein, you know, who I grew up with, you know, who were all Misfits fans. And one day I had gone to New York for a show, and my car got broken into, and my cassettes got stolen. And one of those cassettes was that original Misfits rehearsal.
God damn it.
And I was like, oh, fuck. You know, and back in those days, it was before the internet. There was no way to record. You know, if I should have just made a second cassette of it, you know, but I didn't really think about it.
Right.
So that thing is gone from memory for years. When the internet happened, and, you know, it started getting into the heyday where, like, you know, punk rock is really starting to show up on the internet, I was like, let me just do a Google search and see if anybody else ever recorded a Misfits rehearsal. So I put, like, Misfits rehearsal into Google, and this bootleg comes up. And it was a pit session, which was the garage, mm-hmm. from the same year that I was there. And I told my wife at the time, it's like, I'm about to listen to this. I mean, if this starts off with the band starting and stopping and Glenn calling Googie a douche, this is my recording.
Maybe he calls Googie a douche every practice.
Dude, sure as shit, this was it. This was my recording. One of my friends who I made a tape for, I don't know even to this day who it was. I have a couple suspicions, but nobody's ever confessed. Somebody made a bootleg of it, pressed a bootleg album of it. Mm. And it got, you know,
hello.
I was able to get this back. You know, I was able to download it and hear it. And it's funny because in between songs, you can hear me and Paul from Adrenaline OD actually laughing at, like, Jerry and Glenn making fun of Googie, you know? And you can hear my voice on it. It's so bizarre that this came up years and years later, you know?
That is bizarre, dude. Yeah.
That was my intro to the Misfits, and I actually became fairly decent, you know, I wouldn't say close friends, but good acquaintance friends with Glenn, because we would always show up at, like, comic book shops in New Jersey at the same time, or record shops, and, you know, we would just start talking to each other, and he invited me over to his house one day, and I had gone down there. This is when he lived with his parents in Lodi, and he lived in the basement. And we were hanging out, and he's showing me, like, all the screen printing stuff that he did all the Misfits posters on, and the shirts on. And he's got a giant record collection. I mean, I remember his walls had, like, built-in, like, shelves. Like, I don't know who made it, but they had, like, shelves to the whole wall. So he had this massive record collection that looked like almost like a library.
Even then.
And yeah, he really, you know, he had all kinds of stuff. And he pulled out one record. I think it was Black Randy and the Metro Squad, mm-hmm. from Danger House Records. And he's like, here, you want this? I was like, okay. He goes, yeah, you can have it. It sucks. And he gave me the record. And so we're down there. We're hanging out. We're talking about all kinds of stuff. Like, you know, we're talking about the Dead Kennedys and the Adverts. He was a big fan of the Adverts.
Me too.
The Damned. Yep. Yeah, me too. So then his mom opens the door to the basement. He's like, and she yells down, hey, Glenn, dinner's ready. He's like, okay. 5 minutes go by, like, we're talking about other shit, and door opens again. It's like, Glenn, dinner's ready. Okay. Another 5 minutes go by, and he's, like, lost in conversation. And she's like, Glenn, your dinner's ready. He's like, okay, Mom. Another 5 minutes go by, and she opens up the door, and she goes, Glenn, the lasagna's getting cold. And he goes, I'm fucking down here with somebody, Ma. And I was like, okay, it's time to go. Go eat your lasagna,
Glenn. Prince of Darkness. Yep.
Prince of Darkness. Man, I remember
the pasta.
Yeah. Well, the pasta could piss you off if it's getting cold. I was at a show with Glenn at CBGB's one time. We both had gone to see a mutual friend's band called Hellbent. And Glenn had, at the time, his leather vest that had that famous Captain Harlot skull on the back of it. And he put it on the stage of CBGB's and walked away for a second. When he came back, somebody stole the vest. And, I mean, he was there for maybe 20 minutes, and we were hanging out, you know, before the show, and he's fucking furious, man. He's fucking like, who the fuck took my fucking vest? I'm gonna fuck check my fucking vest. I'm gonna fucking kill somebody. He's fucking screaming, and that was it, man. He fucking got so pissed off, he left. I guarantee you that was the very last time that Glenn ever went to CBGB's ever again. That was like 84, I think, 83, something like that.
Wow. So somewhere out there is Glenn's vest.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Or, you know, you never know. It could have just been some, like, you know, idiot that needed some drug money and just sold it, not realizing, you know. CBGB's was kind of nutty back then, so you never knew.
Well, I tell you what, let's play the title track from the book, I guess, right? If it's Tuesday, this must be Walla Walla. What is, okay, so well, obvious, kind of obvious what this one's about, but why don't you describe it a little bit?
Well, the reason I even called the book If It's Tuesday, This Must Be Walla, Walla Walla, was because we had played like these ragers of shows. We had done this series of shows on the 85 tour where we had played with Poison Idea and Battalion of Saints in Portland, and then the Q show in Seattle. And they were both like packed, and the crowd was just going fucking off. And then the next show we did was in Walla Walla, and it was at like a local like high school, and nobody knew who the fuck we were. Everybody kept coming up to us and asking, "What part of Walla Walla are you guys from?" And it was just like, "Where are those? What the fuck? How do we get this show?" So it was just one of those funny fucking things on tour, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's listen to it. If It's Tuesday, This Must Be Walla Walla, Adrenaline OD. Adrenaline OD, If It's Tuesday, This Must Be Walla Walla, name of the book. What album is that off of?
That is off of Cruising with Elvis and Bigfoot's UFO, which is probably one of my favorite records, just because it sounds so goddamn good. It's the first time that like anybody actually had drums captured properly on an AOD record. You know, it's like every other record, especially like, you know, starting from Let's Barbecue, we didn't know what the hell we were doing. Our drums sounded like Tupperware, you know. It didn't sound like a drum set. It just, you know, I could have been tapping my hands on Tupperware and just would have sounded as good. But we got Daniel Ray, who was, you know, he produced the Ramones and the Misfits and Iggy Pop, and we were really a big fan of him because he was the guitar player for a band called Shrapnel from New Jersey, which were a first wave Jersey punk rock band that were pretty big. And the singer in that band was Dave Windorf, who went on to Monster Magnet. And the bass player, Phil Caivano, went on to Monster Magnet and Blitzbeer. That band like was such a big influence on AOD, you know, because that was like, we didn't have a blueprint. There wasn't a lot of punk rock bands in New Jersey. those guys were actually playing a lot. They were opening for the Ramones all the time. They were playing big clubs. They were a big influence on us. We really loved them. So having Daniel, who really knew what he was doing in a studio, come in just made all the difference. It really changed everything for us, because we had no fucking clue what we were doing in the studio, you know, ever. So it's like, okay, we'll turn knobs because, you know, it looks cool.
Turn it up to 11, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Tom is saying, he's telling me you should go, and you have. You've been very generous with your time. But the one thing I would like you to talk about a little bit is that feeders show at Gilman. Because that was probably my favorite story in the whole book.
I love that you did the National Enquirer, and that they said rock star. Those dead animals, like rock star. Yeah.
I'm sure Frank Discussion loved that too.
Yeah.
that show is actually, I would say, probably the most fucked up weird show we've ever played, ever.
Yeah.
And it was completely my fault, because we were going to be playing Gilman Street. We were friends with Tim Yohannan, who was booking it, and he asked me who we want to open for them. And at the time, I was thinking, like, that Mr. T Experience record just came out. I was digging them, so I was like, okay, those guys. And I heard that the Feeders moved to San Francisco.
Oh, no.
For a match with the Feeders. And Tim's like, you know, it's a long shot. Those guys really, really don't play. I'll ask them, but don't expect anything. Like, 3 days later, he calls me back. He's like, hey, they said yes. I was like, oh, fucking great. I get to see the Feeders. This is awesome. So, day of the show, Feeders come on, and this is Gilman Street. I mean, we're talking Berkeley, Maximum Rock and Roll run place. It is the most liberal place in the punk rock scene in the United States. The Feeders come on stage, and their singer, Frank Discussion, he's bald. He has glued to his head live cockroaches upside down. So their little legs are moving, but they can't get away. He has a dead dog draped around his neck, and hanging from a noose around his collar is a dead cat. And he starts the show by throwing the dog into the pit and saying, "Hey kids, lassies, come home." Now, shit just starts right off the bat, man. It got like fucking crazy quick. And like, I remember, like, these girls that came up on stage, and they're debating the band, and the band are like, well, you know, these animals came from the ASPCA, they were already killed, you know, they were dead animals to begin with. It didn't matter. The show gets crazier. They Biafra had come to the show to see us.
Oh, boy.
And his wife, Ninotchka, had just left him for Frank Discussion for the Feeders, who was Jello's best friend at the time and roommate. And not only did she leave Biafra for Frank, I think she cleaned out his bank account too, and then left him. So now Biafra comes to see us, and he's got to deal with the Feeders. They call her up to do a song with them, he's just... I think it was a song about like cheating or something like that. So like he left in tears. I remember him walking out of the place. I was like, I can't deal with this. So he leaves. They have this giant basket on stage that was on stage the entire time, and nobody knew what the fuck the basket was. Frank Discussion says, we got a song called Basket Case, and takes the lid off this basket, and there's this dude in a wheelchair who's got like cerebral palsy or something, and he's spitting and sputtering and jerking around, and the band like launches into the song called Basket Case, and then like it just devolved into chaos. I mean, everybody in the crowd started like yelling at the band, and drinks are getting thrown at the band, and the band are throwing the drinks back on the crowd. And this show gets done, and like, the, you know, we're just like, how the fuck do we follow?
How do you follow that?
It's like you're following Gigi Allen after he just shit the place up. You know what I'm saying? It's like, how do you go on after that? But that show was fucking incredible, man. Well, one of the most punk rock moments, you know, I've ever seen, to be honest with you. That was just insane.
Yeah, I wish people had cell phones back then, because I would pay to see that. That one sounds awesome.
I'll be honest with you. Timmy O'Hannon recorded the entire show, and it is on YouTube. So if you want to watch it, have at it, guys. You can see the entire thing, and it's incredible.
Well,
it's like watching a car crash.
And the funny thing is that first Fetus album, Ever Feel Like Killing Your Boss, is absolutely classic. That is a fucking great record.
Well, that's why I got him on the bill. I fucking loved that fucking record, dude. And it's funny. It's like I was really getting into that record at the time. And I was going to college at the time. And, like, you know, Frank Discussion was... He was really like into the Abby Hoffman, like, steal this book concept, you know, mm-hmm. just like, you know, fuck consumerism. And I remember going into my college library and getting Abby Hoffman steal this book. And I tried to walk out of the library and actually steal this book. And the alarm went off because I didn't take the little sensor out of the book. I was like, I got so scared. I ran into the bathroom and I threw the book down and ran away. That was my entire experience with the feeder's situationalism. You know, I was too much of a pussy for that.
Dude, that's awesome. Awesome stuff. Well, Tom, are you still there, right?
I'm here, man.
Okay, good.
Wake up!
No, I'm all good. What are we saying for songs, Neil?
He's got one more song left, which is Bugs, but obviously he can do whatever
he wants to do. Let's pivot and talk about... So, Adrenaline OD is on my... You know, my loose, what I call my bucket list of bands. I thought this was going to be the year. I know nothing's been announced yet, but I know already some stuff has changed. I don't want to be the spoiler on anything. But what are we playing some shows this year, Dave? What's going on with the band currently?
We are playing shows. The game plan was to go all in this year. Our singer, he had been unemployed. He got laid off, I think, over 3 years ago. He had a decent job, you know, I think he was in computer programming. And he got laid off during COVID. And it was really, really hard for him to find another job because he's over 60. And, you know, in the computer field, nobody wants to hire somebody at that age.
You hear that, Neil? You hear that?
Yeah. Hey, I better hold on to my
job.
Neil's job,
too.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got to realize that there's kids that'll work for half your salary that know more than you do about computers at this point. And nobody wants to hire you because they know you're going to retire eventually, you know? Mm-hmm. So he had the hardest time finding a job. So I was like, listen, Paul, it's been 3 years. I know this is hard for you. You're not bringing any money in. You have the ability to, you got this band to fall back on. We could go all in. We could do weekend shows. We've been offered all these festivals over the years. Tons of them. Tons of big shows. And we always have to pass on them. So he's like, after that last round of shows we did in when the book came out, and he had a great time, he's like, okay, I'm all in. Let's go for it. So I got us an agent, and, you know, we're starting to book stuff, and he gets a job. He gets a real job. It's not just like a job like at, you know, Walgreens, you know, checkout. He right. got a real job, a career job that, you know, is where he's got to work Monday through Friday. And that was the end of 80 kind of aspirations we had of weekend flyout shows and festival shows. So the only thing we can do is what we have done in the past, and that's play the tri-state area you know, and that's what we're doing in starting May 31st. We're playing Dingbats in Clifton, my hometown. Then the next day we're playing Cherry Street Station in Connecticut. And the next day we're headlining a punk rock festival back on the Bowery at Bowery Electric in New York City for a matinee. So that's like full circle right there. And there's other stuff that we're trying to work on. There's one gigantic fucking show that hasn't been announced yet, and I can't announce what it is yet. But if that happens, I could retire and be happy. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see. But there is, there, you know, and I've told every member of the band this. We're heading into, like, an area where no band has been of our genre before. Nobody's made a major motion picture about anybody in the Dead Kennedys or Black Flag. You know what I'm saying? It's like, we got, in a year, this is going to be out. You know, maybe a year to 2 years. Then so you're that, everything's going to change.
You're that confident this thing's going to happen.
Oh, my God, yeah. And not only am I that confident it's going to happen, I am telling you straight out, guys, and you could quote me on this, this is fucking the funniest fucking comedy, punk rock-inspired road movie ever made. I mean, it is up there with It's a Mad, 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 Mad World as far as
holy shit,
comedy road movies go. It is nonstop funny, and like the book, I am doing this just like AOD was. Fast, quick, and funny. You're never going to get bored because we're in a different city every day, and something completely different happens, and the cast of characters is completely different, and it's all based on reality. So nobody can have my fucking story, you know.
That sounds awesome. I hope that happens. The only reason I'm skeptical is because I've been waiting for that damn Joey Ramone biopic for like 5 years now with Pete Davidson that they said was going to happen.
Just as well.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know what? It's like, I think that when you go like that big, that it takes a lot more. I got a kind of movie that nobody's done in a long time, and I think it's touching a nerve with all these people in Hollywood that are in the movie industry that are my age, because I'm like, listen, this isn't a Motley Crue biopic. This is, like I said, this is has more in common with, like, you know, like I got Bad News Bears too. It's just funny. It brings you back to the 80s. You know, it's a time capsule back to that era too, on top of the story. And so far, you know, I go back and I, you know, I'll take like I'll write a bunch of chapters on this. I'll write a bunch of scenes, and I'll take like 3 to 4 weeks off and not do anything, not look at it, and then look at it fresh. And I go back and I look at it fresh, and I'm fucking loving it, dude. And I'm picky. I am really picky. I don't think there's been funny movies in a really long time.
Are you allowed to make funny movies anymore?
Yeah, it's almost illegal at this point.
It really almost is, right? The kids don't think funny is funny anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think filmmakers or film companies know what funny is funny is anymore, for that matter.
You know who knows funny is, Neil? The singer for the Feeders.
There you go. Yeah. Along with the guy from the Crucifix, right? The guy with the Crucifix, too.
Yeah. Oh, I love Doc Dart. That guy rules, man.
Yep.
We got to meet him. This is another great story. You know, you talk about like classic bills. We did a show at a old VFW hall or something in Wisconsin with DOA and the Dicks, and we had an after party, and like Doc Dart from the Crucifix showed up. So it was like, oh, you're hanging out with all these people just like the whole night. It's just, you know, as a punk rocker and get to pick the brains of people like that you've always been like enamored by. It was just such a fun time to grow up. It really was. You know,
there you go.
And some of those friends that we made, like Joey Shithead, I'll see Joey every time he comes around, man. And you know, it's like, I love that guy. You know, yeah. There's so many people that we've met that I still am in pretty good touch with. You know, it's like you make these friends, and it's like a bond for life with some of these people. You know,
That's beautiful. That's beautiful, man.
Well, I'll tell you what, man. I would love that. I hope that movie gets made.
Yep.
I hope I still get a chance to catch you guys before you can't play those drums anymore fast enough.
Yeah. Well, I'm good until my first stroke.
There you go.
They're going to start doing an acoustic show. They'll do the acoustic slow versions.
After the stroke, they're going to put him in a wheelchair in a big wicker basket.
The feeders will bring him out.
Oh, yeah. I got a good point there. Wow, I'll be down for that. At least it's excitement after, you know, everything goes to shit, you know? Yeah,
that's true.
There you go.
Okay, so the last song is Bugs. What do you tell us about this one?
This is my magna opus. This is
this is a stairway to heaven, Neil.
This is my stairway to heaven. Yeah, this is one of the few songs I actually wrote. I wrote this with Jack, our bass player. It was based on back in the day before Jerry Springer show got all about like strippers fighting with each other on stage. They were, it was kind of like sensationalism.
Yep,
TV. I remember
that. Yep.
And they had a guy on that believed that the country was going to be taken over by bugs, and he built a bunker, and he stocked his bunker with, like, you know, cans of pork and beans and stuff, like, you know, like a doomsday bunker, because sure, he thought the bugs were going to take over. So I was like, that was the impetus for writing that song, was just the stupidity of some fucking people. But the funny thing is that, I mean, over the years, that song's become so popular that, you know, people, like, jump up on stage, like, you know, you see these big skinheads, like, with muscles and tattoos, and they're just screaming at the top of their lungs, bugs, bugs, like, you know, like, it means something so much to them, you know, it's always cracked me up, you know, it's like, I've made jokes, it's like, you know, these guys must be exterminators at this point.
There you go, yeah. Love it.
And the truth of the matter is, listen, just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean the guy wasn't right.
That's right.
Yeah. You got a point, man.
The Earth will
roach isn't going to be the last one left anyway. So.
Exactly. They outnumber us.
See some of those movies from the 50s, some of those sci-fi movies from the 50s, dude.
Yeah.
Giant ants and shit.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
I think the best lyrics I ever wrote were in that song, and that is, two arms, we only have two arms. How can we fight them when the raid is gone? It's like the stupidest fucking lyrics ever, dude.
Well, you were a teenager. It's all right.
Yep.
All right. Let's listen to it, everybody. Let's listen to it and be scared of the fucking bugs that are going to kill us all. All right. Adrenaline OD bugs.
Awesome. We'll be right back.
All right, everybody. That was the final one from Adrenaline OD tonight. That was Bugs. Unless there's anything he wants us to play out with. Is there anything he's missed that he would think we should hear on the way out?
Nope, you played that. Every good song we've ever played.
Oh, shit,
I'm
don't
sorry.
Say that. Don't say that.
What this makes me wonder, though, I mean, we've just talked Dave for 2 hours.
Yep.
Like, and I think they're all wise asses. Like, I think we probably could do this with, like, almost every one of them individually, at least Bruce, right?
Yeah, no, there's nobody. You know, it's funny because the one person that really never has done podcasts is our singer, Paul, who's very quiet and very reserved. And he just did a podcast that came out yesterday. The first time I've ever seen him do a podcast, I was fascinated by it because the motherfucker is so goddamn quiet. I didn't know shit about him.
You learn more about him than you did 10 years in the band.
Yeah. It was like, where were you when I was writing the book, motherfucker? So I'm finding out all these funny stories. But yeah, everybody in the band has the same sense of humor. You will get like a good interview with anybody. We're all cut of the same cloth, you know.
Well, listen, man, it was a lot of fun to talk to you. I really enjoyed it, and I can't encourage everybody enough to check out those first three records, especially. We've already kind of discussed Ishtar, which I actually don't know that record, so I can't really speak against it. But the first three records are all back in print on Beer City at the moment. They're all great. The book is very entertaining. Neil, I think, read it in one day.
So I did.
Like 300 pages, like tore through it. I took a little longer, but yeah, it was a great read. Enjoyed it. Maybe wish I was there.
Awesome. So. That's what I want. I had given a copy to my friend Buzzo from the Melvins, and that night, like, he stayed up the entire night and just finished the entire book, and like he messaged me the next day. It's like, it was fucking great, dude. I couldn't put it down. It's like, that's what I want. You know, I want people to be like at least entertained. You know, it's not so much that I want you to learn the history of the band. I want you to learn how much fun it was to be in a band back then. You know?
There you go. Well, I think you succeed in that. And we've read a couple things now. I've got to say, this little publisher, this little upstart publisher, I'm pretty impressed so far. And
that's true.
Yep. They're already advertising their next title. And I think I'd like to have that guy on too. So hopefully this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Yeah, DeWolf Publishing, or like the little engine that could. They're exactly what I appreciate about punk rock. It's like young upstarts just like, hey, we're just gonna fucking do it. We're gonna put out stuff that we enjoy, and if people enjoy it, cool.
Learn as we go.
Really good job, man. Yeah, learn as you go. They've done a great job, and I couldn't be happier.
All right. I think I've said all I can say. What about you, Neil?
Yep. The book is called If It's Tuesday, This Must Be Walla Walla, The Wacky History of Adrenaline OD. And, everybody should check it out and buy it. Will you sign it? Like, can people, like, send off to you or something, and you'll sign him a copy or something like that? I mean,
I could probably work something out. Since I'm going back to do AOD shows in the end of May, I'll probably end up signing like a bunch of books so they have them on hand this way, you know.
Yeah, gotcha. That makes sense. Okay. Dude, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, it's, thanks for your time,
it's
Dave.
Been
thanks
generous.
To you guys. I had a great time. This was fun.
It was fun.
Yep. So, all right. Well, until next time, everybody. Keep a little more.
Yeah, listen, we might have to have another conversation when this major motion picture comes out.
Damn straight. Fuck yes.
Yep.
Well, he'll be too big of a star by then. He's not going to
fucking
talk to us.
That's true. He'll blow us off and be like, I'm sorry, I only talked to Joe Rogan.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll have to talk to my agent. I'm sorry.
So, everybody, thank you. Keep a little mark in your heart. Stay free. Hope you enjoyed it tonight.
Stay hardcore.
Stay hard. There you go. All right. Bye, everybody.
Take care.
Okay, that brings us to the end of another show. Hope you enjoyed it. Remember, keep a little mark in your heart, and we'll be back the same mark time, same mark channel.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated, good night.
What a fucking rotter.
Fuck till I die. What a load of old shit.
Thank you, fuck you, bye, boom.
Okay.
This is Rock and Roll Radio. Stay tuned for more rock and roll.